Okay, well, I think there will be a parade of people saying similar things to some extent today. And the first thing I want to say is that I, too, once thought that potassium chemistry was simple. I have been disabused of that notion. But after all, we have been studying soil potassium for decades. It was in 1939 that William Peer published a paper on availability, fixation, and liberation of potassium in soils in Iowa. And as Don mentioned, Charles Rich's work was summarized in a review paper on mineralogy of soil potassium in 1968. That paper, that chapter actually guides much of our thinking today. And the work that Don did along with P.M. Wong in separating out the pools that Ballant just mentioned into different forms of potassium in soils. I mean, this is a venerable diagram that we use all the time. I've highlighted fixed K in the center here because that's what I'm going to talk about for the most part today. But here are some of those images that Don showed a few minutes ago about how potassium can be fixed either in vermiculite or in wedge sites or in hydroxyinterlayered sites. And one of the new twists, I guess it's not new anymore, but a little bit different perspective on potassium fixation was suggested by the work of Joe Stuckey and Charles Roth in the 1980s and 1990s, where they found that the reduction of iron in smectite crystals can increase layer charge and in that respect increase the cation exchange capacity and presumably the fixation potential for potassium. But as we all know, soils consist of intimate mixtures of clay and organic matter with a lot of variety both in the chemistry, the mineralogy, and the morphology and the arrangement of constituents. So at the microscale, what goes on at the microscale may not be very well understood or reflected at the macro scale. So why? Why is it so darn complicated? My graduate student, Taslima Stephen, and I have been working on this question just for a couple of years, and honestly, I feel like I'm in the wrong room to be talking with you folks, some of you who have been working on this topic for decades, but I'll proceed anyway, since I was kindly invited to give this talk. Now, my favorite movie, okay, one of my favorite movies is The Life of Pi. Now, raise your hand if you've seen it. Life of Pi, it's a fantastic movie. If you haven't seen it, you really should. By analogy, I'm going to suggest a little story about the life of K, which starts, of course, with K in mineral structures, gets released by a variety of processes, including the impact of hydronium ions and organic ions at complex aluminum, releasing K to exchangeable forms in soils which are primarily, if not exclusively, smectite and vermiculite. Those are the low-energy sites that we've heard folks talk about already. Some of K can then be moved to exchangeable organic forms in response to pH changes and site selectivity in the organics, or some of the K may also move to fixed sites that are in edges or wedges, or as I'll show in a few minutes, some of those sites respond to redox potential. Well, once K is in the exchange, on the exchange sites, it is released in the soil solution in response to primarily exchange gradients between potassium and calcium and magnesium. But once the K is there swimming around in the ocean, those of you who've seen Life of Pi remember swimming around in the ocean. Once it's swimming around in the soil solution ocean, a lot of other things can happen to it. It may be joined by K from fertilizer. It could be joined by K from lateral movement from other sites by evapotranspiration. And then finally, it reaches the nirvana, the mystery of crop uptake. Well, okay, as a soil scientist, that's where the mystery truly begins for me. What I'm going to talk about for the next few minutes is what happens at these fixed sites, in particular some of the sites that respond to redox potential. Now, our hypothesis was similar to what Joe Suki's hypothesis was. That is, that under flooded conditions, the redox potential of the soil goes down. As it goes down, iron gets transformed from iron 3 to iron 2. That's iron in the clay minerals. So this cation exchange capacity increases. As a result, iron could, or rather potassium could be fixed at those sites where iron has been reduced. But there are certainly mitigating factors that might make one question that hypothesis. For example, the soil might not be saturated long enough at a high enough temperature for the redox potential to get low enough to get down to iron 2. Or when EH does get low enough for the reduction, iron oxides may be dissolved, opening up more non-selective sites on the smectite or organic matter and increasing the cation exchange capacity. So you may have a small number of highly selective sites that get swamped out by a larger number of very low energy sites. Organic matter associated with clay may also block access to the selective sites. And another mitigating factor is that as redox potential goes down, at least in acid soils, the pH tends to rise, increasing the cation exchange capacity, and again, increasing the proportion of non-selective sites for potassium retention. Well, we decided to look at this question by using some soil materials gathered from a biomass production cropping systems research site, which is in central Iowa. This is the site where we worked, and it consists, I'm not going to go through the treatments because of the biomass treatments, they aren't particularly relevant to our experiment, but we collected soil samples from a variety of these plots. We composited samples from each of the plots and then conducted our experiments on those samples. Now, one of the reasons we did that was because we wanted the mineralogy to be relatively uniform but still have a range of other properties that we could look at. So, I said I wasn't going to talk about the treatments, but there they are. The biomass treatments include continuous corn, a couple of reconstructed prairies, and then a corn-soybean rotation. Well, of the samples we collected, we did get a range of properties. These are the quintessential soils in Iowa, Clarion, Nicolet, and Webster soils, where our clay concentrations range from a low of about 22% up to 35%. The organic carbon ranged from a low of about 2% up to 3.3%. Our cation exchange capacities ranged from 28 to 47. So we had a fairly good representation of the range of properties that we might expect. The clay mineralogy in these sites is dominated by smectite, or whatever we want to call that material that expands in glycerol to about 18 angstroms. There is a little bit of vermiculite. That's this 14 angstrom shoulder on the X-ray pattern, and a little bit of clay mica and about maybe 15 to 20% of kaolinite in these soils. One of the first things we asked was how much potassium could we possibly fix? And so we went back to M.L. Jackson's work and what Kaufman and Fanning did in the 70s to do the difference between cation exchange capacity determined with calcium versus cation exchange capacity determined on a sample saturated with potassium that's been heated overnight at 110. The maximum potassium fixation capacity that we found in those soils was maybe 3 to 6 centimoles per kilogram, which amounts to a substantial portion of the total CEC if it were all available for fixation. Now, the main experiment that we did was one that Ballant just mentioned. That's the classic QI experiment, where we do potassium adsorption isotherms over mixing a known mass of soil with a range of potassium concentrations and equilibrating that, determining potassium, calcium, and magnesium in solution. One thing that we did then was at the end of the equilibration period, we determined the exchangeable potassium on the samples by rinsing the samples, if you will, with ammonium acetate. And then the other thing which was different was we applied three treatments. First of all, we used an 18-hour equilibration treatment, which is sort of the classic QI approach. Our second treatment was to keep the samples anaerobic under nitrogen with no possibility of oxygen being admitted for 14 days. And then the third treatment was the same as the second, but we added some glucose just to make sure that the redox potential really got down to where we wanted it to be. This is what those kinds of exchange isotherms look like when you partition out the amount of potassium that you've added into non-exchangeable forms, exchangeable forms, and then the total K. So under aerobic conditions, we found a change in the buffer capacity for the non-exchangeable to increase only slightly, but over that period, or under those conditions, we found a change in the buffer total buffer capacity to increase. That's this top line up here. The slope of the line would be the buffer capacity from the QI experiment. In contrast, for those samples that really had a low redox potential, where we had added glucose and incubated for 14 days, we increased the buffer capacity for the non-exchangeable K, that's this line down here. It went, for example, from about 7 to 32, but we also significantly increased the buffer capacity for total K. And the reason is because we were also increasing this label is wrong. This one goes down here to the green, and this label goes up here to the blue. So this is the change in exchangeable K. This is the change in non-exchangeable K. Well, our hypothesis was that the non-exchangeable K would increase as a result of low redox potential. Well, okay. Our hypothesis was fine, but we didn't predict the overall increase in potassium buffering capacity as a result of the change in redox potential. The simple statistics look like this. This is the non-exchangeable buffer capacity comparing the aerobic to the anaerobic or the anaerobic plus glucose treatment. And both the anaerobic treatments had greater non-exchangeable buffer capacity, certainly. When we look at the total buffer capacity, though, we also see significant differences among the aerobic, the anaerobic, and the anaerobic plus glucose treatment, with a very high probability that these are meaningful treatment effects. If we partition out the averages, the non-exchangeable buffer capacity was about 5 centimol. Well, this is centimoles per kilogram divided by centimoles per kilogram of calcium and magnesium raised to the 1/2 power. That's the concentration ratio. So about 5 in the aerobic treatment. The exchangeable went up to 23, and the total was 45. At the end of our equilibration period. So about 11% of the total change in buffering capacity had to do with non-exchangeable potassium. But under the glucose low redox conditions, we certainly increased the amount of non-exchangeable potassium. We also increased the amount of exchangeable potassium. And so the total buffer capacity increased significantly from 45 up to 72 and up to 88. Now that really leaves us scratching our heads, at least it does me. What is it about a change in redox potential that would change not only the potential for fixing K at high energy sites, but also the potential for fixing K or at low energy sites, which would be the exchangeable. So we have a rich data set. We started to do just simple correlation coefficients. We tried to match the non-exchangeable buffer capacity with a variety of soil properties. I won't show you all of them. I'll just show you a couple. We asked, well, could the increase in non-exchangeable buffer capacity be related to the depth to which the redox potential went, the equilibrium EH at the end of the equilibration period? And our scatter plots show, no, there's no real relationship to that. There's not even a relationship between the increase in non-exchangeable buffer capacity and the percent clay. That was a surprise. On the other hand, the increase in the exchangeable buffer capacity, well, again, didn't show much relationship to clay, but it does show a relationship to the redox potential. So again, I'm interpreting this to mean that something about the change in redox potential changes the abundance of low-energy sites associated with readily exchangeable potassium. And our correlation coefficient there was 0.73. So let's see, what's our conclusion? Well, to quote another movie, it's complicated, but we think that reducing conditions increase the capacity of the soil to buffer added potassium at both exchangeable and non-exchangeable sites. We speculate, this is still speculation, that the increase in the sites holding non-exchangeable potassium was due to changes in the oxidation state of iron, that's the Stuckey hypothesis, and the subsequent fixation of potassium in the interlayer sites. But we also speculate that the increase in sites that were holding exchangeable potassium, those are the low energy sites, was because of an increase in CEC as iron oxides were dissolved when the redox potential went down. Now this happened over a period of 14 days. So in Iowa, most of our soils are tile drained. We don't have periods of saturation exceeding, it will be rare to have a period of saturation exceeding 14 days. But the fact that we did have that reduction in, the increase in potassium buffer capacity, which would be a decrease in the buffer power of potassium getting into the soil solution, would be significant over those 14 days. So now I'm at the point where instead of whining about why is it so complicated, I'm trying to think of this story of potassium in the same way that the writer and director of Life of Pi thought about the story of Pi. It's a beautiful mystery. There are many ways that we can tell the story, but we need to keep telling the story to one another. A lot of people have contributed to these last couple of years of our work on potassium. I really want to acknowledge David Laird's contributions to my thinking about potassium and my discussions with Randy Southern and Antonio Mallarino, Teresita Chua have been very helpful as well. Grad students in our group have participated in our project as well. So I thank you all for your attention.